Richard Neal, I'm going to name some things you know, wax poetic. The presidential election, who's going to win?
I think the president is going to win. And I was reviewing polling data very early this morning at a briefing, and a pretty good pollster was laying out the states that are being contested.
Sure.
And the states that are being contested, they're pretty obvious. And the Washington Post, about 3 weeks to a month ago, they ran a very probing story that I thought caught the attention of anybody who's really riveted on what these presidential politics are at that time, 3 months out, I'm sorry, 5 months out, and now 4 months out. But you don't just want to go by what the candidates are saying they're contesting. You want to go by where the money is being spent. Example, money's being spent in the Boston media market, not because Massachusetts is being contested, but because you need to reach southern New Hampshire. And New Hampshire is in play. The Cleveland suburbs are in play. The president in many of the states that for the moment are up for grabs, he has a bit of a lead. And that would include Ohio and Iowa and Florida and Nevada. And having said all of that, though, there is a great volatility that remains out there in the presidential contest. And that means that there are those who have yet to make up their minds, even though at the moment at the presidential level, close to 90% of the American voters have made up their minds. So you want to find out in that instance who's going to vote, what their track record is of voting, and then you want a message that is probably different than the message you've used with the base of your respective parties. And that message typically is meant to address issues that the independent voter is interested in. Certainly education is one of the issues that they're interested in. They're concerned about global warming. They're concerned about America's position in the world, and they're concerned about deficits. And they tend to sift through the punditry, and they tend to sift through the spin. And they also don't make up their minds for sure until the last 2 weeks out. And that's the group right now that President Obama and former Governor Romney are in pursuit of, even though they're saying that this is a nationwide race.
Richard Neal, you have a very important post in the United States Congress. You're on the Ways and Means Committee. A lot of people think you might be the chair, assuming election, of this incredibly important committee. And along comes the Supreme Court and rules on the Affordable Care Act. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, carries it for the extension of the act, or the Validity Act, and yet he's quite nasty about as in his obiter dicta, describing the whole thing. So I wonder if you could pray-see this whole thing from where you're sitting.
Well, what was interesting about the court's decision, there were many of us who speculated the decision might be 6-3. And how the court arrived at their determination is going to be analyzed for decades to come. But recall, even in the instance of Brown versus the Board of Education.
Let me just stop you. 6-4.
Four.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
And surprised that it was 5-4 because there was the belief that while Roberts was in play, that Kennedy was almost a sure thing. And Kennedy's position was entirely contrary to the speculation. So I listened to the pundits here for a long period of time, and they would say, well, Congressman, what do you think is going to happen? And I would say, I really don't know. And I think that was an honest assessment. But when you look back at Brown versus the Board of Education, for example, in 54, one of the things that Earl Warren did, he spent a lot of time addressing the political side of the issue as opposed to the constitutional side of the issue. And he came to the conclusion, as Everett Dirksen would say with the Civil Rights Act of 64, that there is a time when a powerful idea has arrived. And that's part of the court's responsibility. Even though they don't stand for election and even though they should not be subject to the whims of public opinion, nonetheless, they are mindful of what consensus means. So I think that what Roberts was saying, as you indicated, with a bit of a back of the hand, he suggested simply that the public's entitled to the consequences of their actions.
And of their representatives, actually.
And of their representatives. But one of the battles that we have had in America over a long, long period of time since the establishment of the court, understanding Jefferson really reviling Marshall, and all the way through Roosevelt's court packing scheme, is that with elected officials, frequently they believe that the federal court system gets in the way of their mandate. And that's the battle over a appointed body for life in those that have to subject themselves to opinion and to policy that they think will address certain issues. So there's always been in our system a certain amount of tension built into the relationship between the elected and the appointed, but not to underestimate another key consideration. And that is, I would believe that it is unwise for the appointed to substitute their version of policy for the elected.
Well, you know, Bush versus Gore, some of the other things. I thought that, frankly, I have a small disagreement with you, Richie Neal, and that is that you're giving a lot of credit to John Roberts and to the court for doing it the right way. I, on the other hand, think that Roberts was thinking about the future of the court. Their reputation is as low as it's ever been because of some of these cases I've talked about. And I think he pulled a real John Marshall, you know, in Marbury versus Madison by turning around and saying, okay, you know, I don't like it, but I'm going to give you what you want in this case, and restores faith in the court to some degree.
Well, if you recall, it was Sandra Day O'Connor's position in Bush versus Gore to stop the recount.
Yep.
She was the one that authored that position. And even though I was very disappointed and very pained by that decision, one of the things that was fascinating about it was the manner in which Gore accepted the court's decision. And you can see that beginning with the Warren Court in our lifetime, that the court has been the whipping boy, largely by conservatives, over decisions that they've taken as to the role of individual liberty. And they have battled back, and beginning with President Nixon, he made the court a major issue and ended up appointing four members of the court even after Carswell had gone down and Clement Haynsworth had gone down. And I think that when you look back at the conservatives, they've used that very effectively to work up the base of the Republican Party. And in fact, you know, when you use the example of people who have sat on the court for a long period of time, you can see now that a president, when he appoints a member of the court, that oftentimes, while they might not control the opinion, nonetheless, that person that they've appointed has wide latitude for years on. I mean, Warren and Brennan disappointed Eisenhower forever. And Kennedy wasn't crazy about many of the decisions of Wizard White.
Yeah.
But having said that, right, I also think that by and large in American history, when you compare the court and the fact that they aren't out scheduling fundraisers and the court is not out running around the country campaigning, that they have a chance for a good deal of reflection.
So how much do you think the electorate is aware of the importance of either electing Obama or not in terms of who is going on the court next?
Well, I think it's a very important consideration. And
yeah, it is important, but do they know it?
Well, I think that you can see that the wide berth that a justice has. I mean, Black was appointed to the court by Roosevelt, and I think he served almost through Johnson. Douglas, the same way. They were New Dealers. And I don't know oftentimes that the voter makes up their minds based upon that determination, but it is a huge consequence of their vote. And those are decisions and determinations that go on well after that president has departed office.
Well, if I were running for president of the United States in this case, I'd sure want people to understand that. I would make sure that they did it via the ads and everything else.
Well, I mean, another thing that's fascinating about this discussion, I got to tell you that, once again, the relationship between Abe Fortas and Lyndon Johnson is fascinating.
Sure.
I mean, Abe Fortas not only was on the court, he was one of his advisors.
We're going to talk about that when we come back the next time, Richie Neal, because I know you have been reading the new biography of Robert Caro's 4th LBJ volume, and we'll talk about that.
Great.